Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 932. My name is Camden Busey. I'm back in Libertyville, Illinois. I'm happy to be back with another excellent conversation lined up for you today. Today I speak with Jonathan Master, the president of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. And we were able to speak recently at the Reformation and Worship Conference held at Midway PCA in Powder Springs, Georgia. This is a conference that's organized by David Hall and Terry Johnson and a wonderful team of people that help put it on. And it was a delightful time where I got to meet with lots of friends and hear many excellent addresses on subjects that truly matter. So take a look at the conference online. We'll have links to that in the episode description. Take a look also at Greenville and head over to gpts.edu for information on what they have going on. Their conference is coming up in March, and then they're going to have a summer seminar in August. Carlton Wynn and I will be there for that. Take a look. You're going to enjoy it. Stay tuned and stay updated with what they've got going on. And listen to this episode now. I'm going to take you over to my conversation with Jonathan Master, held in the library over at Midway PCA during the Reformation and Worship Conference. All right, well, we're back here in the library at Midway Presbyterian Church. Really excited to be here for the Reformation and Worship Conference, and I have with me now Jonathan Master, who, if you're watching, everyone can see, who's president of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary, also has spoken here at the conference. Welcome, Jonathan.
Camden,
welcome to my office.
Oh, it is great to be with you. It is great to be with you.
Off here in the corner of this library. Yeah, I'm excited to catch back up with you and talk about how things are going at Greenville. You did give a lecture speaking about training pastors and churches to appreciate the confessions. This conference is the Reformation and Worship Conference, but there's always a heavy dose of confessional theology and the significance and importance of our confessional tradition. So a lot of people have been speaking on that. Carl Truman spoke on that yesterday to a degree. Chad Van Dixhorn's here speaking quite a bit about the Westminster Assembly and different aspects of that. And appreciated your lecture as well. So I'm excited about that, but not just to speak about it in general. You're actually putting it to work, you know, at the seminary, educating people. And before we maybe get into the meat of it and speak about your address and talk about how things are going at the seminary, just explain a bit about your time here. Have you been to this conference before?
And you know, I have been here before, and I was last scheduled to speak. Well, last year I couldn't come. I can't remember. There was a conflict, so I had something else I had agreed to do. And then I was also scheduled to speak before in 2020, but COVID kind of canceled the conference for a few years. I don't remember how many years. So it's been a little while since I've been able to be here. Mm-hmm. Greenville Seminary always has a presence here. Mm-hmm. We have close ties with Midway and with other guys who are speaking. Yeah. And so, it's a conference that's really close to our hearts.
Oh, and I've always been wanting to come here, but it's another one of those things where you come here and you just feel like these are our people.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Even as an OP guy. But when I come down here and I hang with these solid, you know, ordinary means of grace, solid confessional PCA types down here, it just feels like these are my folks.
Yeah, there's a great affinity. That's one of the great things about the conference and the way that Dr. Hall and Dr. Johnson have organized it is there is a kind of there's just a lot of time to talk to other guys and to see friends that maybe you wouldn't see very often, and so it's a very collegial atmosphere.
Yeah, it does feel that way. That it's these people love each other. They've been working together and been partners in church ministry for ages. It's very evident. So yeah. It's wonderful. What a great thing. So tell me how things are going at Greenville. We know you're taking over the world. Everything's great.
You know, the Lord has been very kind to us. We have had in the last 3 years in succession, our largest classes, and this year was the same. But more than the size or the numbers, what's really encouraging to me is the kind of men who are being drawn to study at the seminary, who are being sent to us by the churches. These are men, as far as we can tell, and you know, this is the fall, and so some of the guys I'm still getting to know, but these are guys who are really committed to Christ, who are working diligently, who are absolutely committed to pouring out their lives in service to the church as pastors. Mm-hmm. And so that's a great joy, just to see these men, to meet their families, and to see their very evident zeal for the cause of Christ.
That's something that I see so apparent in the student body, but it's apparent in I think most of, well, at least everyone I come into contact with that's in the orbit of the seminary, whether staff member, faculty member, student, prospective students, even your board, your supporters. You know, we come to a lot of these events. We see each other a lot at things, and I'm good friends with a lot of Greenville folks, and I love that. But there's some of the people that I always look forward to seeing, even when I'm coming to another event. But it's just evident, especially in the last several years, how the Lord has been blessing and how there is just a great enthusiasm, and I like that word even better, zeal. And it's real. It's authentic. Mm-hmm. It's not hype. But you've done a wonderful job leading this seminary. But there's a lot of wonderful people laboring and all pulling in the same direction at Greenville, from my perspective. And you're very open, forthright, and just honest and unapologetic about what you care about and what you stand for. And people get excited about that, and they want to be part of it. And so, you know, that's what's behind it. So yes. It's fun to come to the conference and see a giant pile of crazy cool new t-shirts, you know, but that excitement isn't about the t-shirts per se. It's like, we're part of this, you know,
yeah.
And we want to send guys here to get trained, and we want guys that come here to care about service in the church. And that's what you're doing. We train pastors is the message. And everything you do is right there. There's nothing that I've seen, and I'm sure you'd agree, that is in conflict with that. You just get rid of anything that's in competition to that, and that's what we focus on. That's what we do.
Laser focus.
Yes.
That's something we talk about a lot, and I think it's something, by God's grace, that we're continuing to try to press forward on. We really just are here to do one thing. We take seriously the fact that the church has called us to do this. We work alongside and underneath the authority and oversight of the church, and we are given a very narrow brief. I think it's a very important mission that we've been given, but it's simple and clear and straightforward, which is training pastors.
Yeah.
And by God's grace, what we want to see are pastors who love the Lord, love the church, love these confessions of faith around which our denominations are united, and are committed to giving their lives for however long the Lord gives them to that one task.
Yeah. And that's borne out not just in aspiration, but more than 90% of your graduates are still in pastoral ministry, what, 5 years or more after the fact?
Is an incredible statistic, and I think maybe I've told you this story before. When we first started calculating these numbers, I didn't believe it. I actually had to be in the room the third time that we calculated it. But the statistics of MDiv graduates are really discouraging in general, not at Greenville, but just in general. Across the country, MDiv graduates, within the first 5 years, only 18% persist in pastoral.
18?
Yeah, it's 18%. This is the most recent study that was done. So, by God's grace, throughout the whole history of our seminary, we don't do just 5-year, 10-year numbers. We look at the whole scope of our history. And through the whole history, we're at about a little over 92% persistence rate. So again, that's the grace of God.
Of course.
We have to thank the Lord for that. But it's incredibly encouraging because you think about making the investment into seminary education, a significant investment for students. They're there, for most of them, they're there 4 years at Greenville, 3 to 4 years other places. And that's a lot of time, but there are other people who support them in that. And to think about that kind of investment leading to an 18% persistence rate is kind of discouraging. But by God's grace, I think what we've seen is our graduates have continued on and have done the work that they were trained to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So there's an interest, there's a zeal for pastoral ministry, but it's also based on intense study on the word and exegesis, but then understanding how our place within this rich tradition, a Reformed and Presbyterian tradition specifically. You know, I'd like to ask you about that role and how this works out in seminary education in general, but even specifically at Greenville. But one thing you argue, and might be really shocking to some people who haven't thought about this, but that Christianity is irreducibly doctrinal. You know, some people might think, well, you know, the doctrine's important, but if we boil it all down, you know, is there something beneath that? Is there some, is there a way to abstract the core essence of Christianity in a way that it's pre-doctrinal or supra-doctrinal? What do you say to that?
Well, there's just not. And I mean, those, even that framing of it that you yeah. quoted is not something that I came up with, although I agree with it entirely. In the address I gave earlier this morning, I quoted from Machen, and mm-hmm. obviously your listeners will be very familiar with him, but he has this great quote where he talks about how Christianity has to be doctrinal or it's nothing.
Yeah.
And he the two quotes that I would put before your listeners, number one, he talks about Paul, and he says Christianity for Paul was not only a life, but also a doctrine.
Yes.
And then he says this, and logically the doctrine came first.
Mm-hmm. This and is then, in Christianity and liberalism.
That's right, yeah. in Christianity mm-hmm. and liberalism. And then mm-hmm. and then a little later on, he says, he puts it this way, Christ died, that is history. Mm-hmm. That's a fact, Christ died. Christ died for our sins, that is doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
Without these two elements joined in an indissoluble union, there is no Christianity. And mm-hmm. I think that's right. If you think about it, it Christianity has to be doctrinal first.
Mm-hmm.
And the life is obviously a significant component. We are given commands by the Lord. We are commanded to live in a certain way. There are implications of the doctrine, but the doctrine has to be logically prior. And yeah. so that's right. Christianity is a doctrinal religion, not fundamentally just a way of life. And
or
that
a feeling.
Is or a feeling. And that, that runs counter though to yeah. so much of what's written today. I think the most popular book that sells under the kind of heading of Christian literature right now explicitly argues against that, mm-hmm. argues that actually it's not really about doctrine, it's about living in the way that Jesus lived, which, if you stop and think about it, is actually a hopeless exercise because none of us could in any way mm-hmm. achieve our salvation through trying to emulate the work of Jesus. But it's also just completely backwards because mm-hmm. Jesus presented his own life and work
mm-hmm.
in terms of teaching, in terms of doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you clearly taught. And then also the Great Commission, he says, go
teach.
Go therefore, yes, and
yeah, make disciples,
baptizing, and then teaching them yes. to observe everything I've commanded
exactly.
you. How is that not doctrinal?
Exactly. No, it has to be considered. And again, I think so many people are deceived in this way. And it, you know, Machen's writing in the context of the liberalism of the 20th century, but that liberalism can take on different forms even today. Mm-hmm. And that impulse to say it's not doctrine, it's about life, is still with us.
Mm-hmm. So how then to connect the dots here in Christian education, whether that's in our families or more systematically and specifically in our churches for congregants or officer training, and then especially also in seminary education as we're trying to train men for gospel ministry, how do we build and found an education that is doctrine first or founded on the doctrine that is expressed in Scripture? What are some ways to do that or thoughts you have?
I think we have to – there's a full-orbed answer to that question. I don't think it's one step or two steps
yeah.
because you certainly have to begin by saying we're going to teach this. We're going to be very transparent mm-hmm. about what we believe, and that's what's going to be taught. There's so much that happens in education that's a kind of bait and switch.
Mm.
People say that this is what they hold to, but then you find out actually, no, it's not what's held to. It's not what's actually taught in the classroom. So there needs to be fundamentally a sincerity, an integrity, a transparency
mm-hmm.
about what is believed, and a willingness to defend and assert those convictions. But then, of
I like
course,
to say, be an open source.
Open
you don't
source.
Want to hide anything from anybody, and you always want to be very forthright and open with this is where we stand.
Exactly
and this is
right.
What we believe.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And from our standpoint as a seminary, we think we owe that not just to our students and not just to donors and others who are part of our community, but we really fundamentally owe that to the churches that have given us this task, because they have certain convictions, and it's incumbent upon us to maintain those convictions. And so there can't be any division there. But it's not just the open statement of the truth, although it has to be an open statement of the truth. It also has to be something that the faculty themselves really believe and really practice in their own life. So it's not that we're saying that only doctrine's important, practice isn't.
What we're saying is practice
flows out of doctrine.
It must, yeah.
And so if you could introduce me to someone who supposedly had all the right doctrines without a corresponding measure of personal godliness, well, what I would say to you is they don't really understand and appreciate and fully embrace those doctrines. But so what we need are men who are going to instruct and teach in such a way that they are both openly stating the truth, but also they actually believe it. And it's part of their lives, and it's part of their life in their home and their life in the world and the way in which they teach in a church context. And so it has to be a full-orbed thing. It can't just be one or the other, but it certainly has to begin with open statement of what we believe the Bible teaches.
Yeah. I wonder if you could speak on that point and flesh that out more, just in terms of how pastors in their churches, how parents in their families, and especially how professors in a seminary can model that sort of thing to the people that they're leading, that they're teaching, especially with regard to not only scripture, but especially with regard to the standards. How do you model, you know, a deference, but also not that, yeah, we subscribe to these things, but they're collecting dust over on the corner, but that, no, we subscribe to these things ex animo. And there's my Midwesternness coming out. Maybe it's ex animo, but I want to say animo.
Sounded great to me. Yeah.
But that we love these and we live this. You know, these are things that are not constricting us, but they're giving us life. I understand these are secondary standards. It's not scripture, but you get my point. Like these doctrines are useful to us, and they help us to flourish rather than just being some sort of rules or procedures that we have on the side.
There are a lot of ways where this comes out. I think it can come out in our worship, our commitment to public worship, our commitment to the particular expression of the local church that most closely corresponds to the doctrine that we believe. So it has a worship component, a church component, we might say. It also has a family component. There are undeniably things that our standards teach that pertain directly to family life, to the way in which you order your time, to the way in which your week is structured, to the way in which you think about and pray for your children and raise your children. There are implications for how you understand your marriage and how it is that you would engage with your wife and so almost every area of your life has something that's touched on it by the standards themselves in some way, or at least they give a backdrop to the way you're going to live your life. And so one question to ask is that the case? I mean, are you living a life of godly sincerity? I mentioned this morning, and I think it's profound. When the Apostle Paul evaluates his ministry near the end of his life, the kinds of ways he describes it are things like we served God with a clear conscience, or we behaved with sincerity before you. And so I think there needs to be a wholeness and an integrity to our lives. But then the other question you could ask is, do you actually teach these things and live by these things and teach others to live by these things even outside of the classroom setting? So
yes.
Look, there are all kinds of ways in which we know the standards seem to cut against the grain of how people today generally think. There's a particular view of creation. There's a particular view of the scriptures. There's a particular view of justification, of election. It teaches us about worship.
How we relate to each other.
How we relate to each, how we relate to each other. Inferiors, superiors. If you read through the Larger Catechism's exposition of the Ten Commandments, you cannot fail to find specific ways in which the Ten Commandments ought to apply to your life in a kind of a granular sense. In terms of how you think and how you engage. And so those are the kinds of tells almost. Does someone really hold to this? Or is it just a framework for one little piece of my life?
Well, that's something you and I both know really well just from history, that this hasn't always been the case in American Presbyterianism. There hasn't always been integrity or sincerity with regard to confessional subscription, that there was a good stretch where a majority of the Presbyterian Church, at least in the North, but it became true in the South as well, were on the books subscribing to these things, but they would subscribe to them almost as if, well, yeah, these were good for the church a couple hundred years ago, but we need a new theory for the present, you know, modern world. Or this was good for to have here as an option, as a potential theory.
Right.
But there needs to be room for other theories. I'm thinking specifically also of the Auburn Affirmation and this idea of the atonement, that yes, we're all cool with the traditional understanding of the atonement, but we should have a tent wide enough to include people that, you know, maybe Jesus didn't die and was raised historically. And there was that idea. And Machen and others, especially that came on to form the OPC, were so insistent, to go back to your original quote, that no, these things matter. These things happened in history, and we need to take seriously our confessional statements. And if we are ministers of the gospel and we've taken vows to these things, then that matters. It means something. And it's not just, I vow not to teach contrary to this, but in my heart, I'm going to believe whatever I will. No. This we're taking vows that we believe these things without reservation, you know, from the heart, that we believe and affirm that this is true, and that we are going to seek to teach and minister according to these things. We need to take that seriously. Do you find that to be, I'm not looking for specific examples unless you have any, but do you find that to be a challenge today? Certainly not maybe in the same way that that we've had, you know, 100 years ago, but there's still always challenges on the edges, I think, for confessional integrity.
There is an anti-doctrinal strain that is in the air.
Yeah.
Not just in our churches, but in the world. And it infects our churches. So there is a sense in which you have people, even ministers of the gospel, who will sort of roll their eyes when any kind of confessional issue is raised, as if that's sort of passé. It's not the most important or central thing. And so that's certainly with us. The just to add to what you said a minute ago, it's particularly indefensible for us in our moment in time to not operate with integrity with respect to the confessions, because none of us are coerced in any fashion to affirm these things. Right. I mean, you might be able to point to a period in history in some place or other where it really was going to be detrimental for you and your family unless you sort of signed on the dotted line with your fingers crossed to some confession of faith. But that is not the age in which we live. There is not a minister in the United States who was coerced into that by the government, or who was forced to make these vows. No, these are vows that were taken with total
freedom.
Yeah. And so then to turn around and somehow look at the confessional standards as a kind of straitjacket or something to be avoided or talked around or again roll your eyes is really hard to defend.
This gets at a related issue that's always perplexed me, and I just don't understand. On this point, I don't understand the progressive impulse, and here's what I mean. They're throughout American Presbyterian history, and it's not just Presbyterian, but just Christianity in America. there's always this notion from within, there are at times a progressive element, and they want to change the church into something it is not. And this is just never, given the fact that we have the freedom to take these vows or not, I just have never really understood the impulse to take these vows and then either change your mind and not agree with them anymore, or to take them, you know, violating the ninth commandment to begin with. You don't mean it in the first place. But then to actively seek to change the church, or to do practices that are in contradiction or contrary to the standards, or your secondary standards or tertiary standards. You got things, you know, in your book of church order that are not allowed. And it just never makes sense to me why we would start doing things, why someone would start doing things that are forbidden, thinking that if we push the envelope here, then eventually this church is going to come alongside us and change, rather than just saying, having integrity and saying, no, we're going to leave because we don't agree with these practices and we're going to start our own thing, or join with another group that believes these sorts of things. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's always been that way. I mean, it's for some reason that seems to be the playbook. But I can't remember whether it's this way in the OPC, but in the PCA, when we take our vows, part of the whole that whole process is that we also say, if at any time my views change on these things, then it's my duty to immediately put that in writing and give it to my session, give it to the presbytery, and then they can evaluate whether this has moved outside the bounds of the vows I've taken or not. And so it's not as if anyone is saying you can never change your mind.
Of course.
Because we're humans, we're sinful, we have limited scopes of ability to understand things. And so people will change. But the point is, there's a mechanism for that.
Mm-hmm.
So at no point are you coerced into remaining under a system that you no longer agree with.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and I think it's sad, but there's more integrity to say, let's say you are persuaded, and this has happened. It happened recently that, Reformed and Presbyterian minister becomes convinced of Roman Catholicism and becomes Roman Catholic. But there's still more integrity in admitting that and leaving than staying and trying to change the church to, you know, participate in Romish practices. Another one that's going to, I'm not trying to be antagonistic, but I mean, this is something we should talk about a little bit more forthrightly sometimes, just the pushing of the boundaries of women's ordination. You know, that's an example of something that clearly the PCA and the OPC, of course, we don't agree with, but people that would prefer that are nevertheless pushing those boundaries from within, even though they don't agree with the rules that they've agreed to abide by. That's an example that's just always perplexed me.
Well, it's perplexing, particularly because, as you mentioned earlier, there are other denominations
exactly
that would share a lot of our convictions, but not that one.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it would seem
to be a congenial landing place if you were a minister and those were your convictions.
Yes, I agree. You mentioned something. I'm going to maybe broaden the lens of our conversation for a second, if you don't mind, if you're willing to go with me. You mentioned about the anti-doctrinal thread or stream that's in the air. I'm wondering what your vantage point is as a seminary president. You see a lot of young men coming to you as new students. You're on the road at conferences and seeing prospective students. And I know my friends, your friends, the guys that are out here doing admissions and marketing and everything, they see a lot of stuff on the ground too. We're living in a difficult time. Times have always been difficult, but I'm thinking as we record, it's a month or so after the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and he had put his finger on, he was pretty extraordinary. I wasn't very familiar with him, but he was an extraordinary person. And it's just interesting to see the follow-up and the reaction to his death and the reflection upon his apologetic and his political work, his evangelism, all that sort of thing. I'm wondering if you notice anything, or if you've recognized you know, these, any of these currents that he had put his finger on and that he was involved in. Are you noticing a change in the young men, or a reawakening to doctrinal things, or even things that matter, kind of like a reaction to the postmodernism and all the relativism we used to have, that people are searching for truth and answers and solid ones that are firm and convicted? You know, is that something that you've seen, a kind of a resurgence of that type of desire?
I don't know if I could give you a baseline and say something has changed and this was a point at which it changed. I don't know that. I will say that generally speaking, the guys that we talk to, now that's a self-selected group, of course.
Yeah, this isn't a scientific survey.
That's right.
Survey.
So that's right. So it's not a scientific survey. So the guys that we talk to are generally very responsive and appreciative of the fact that we are transparent about our convictions, mm-hmm. and that our convictions are convictions that have been held by Bible-believing Presbyterians for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And there's not a whole lot of novelty. There's not a whole lot of difference. There are just some through lines that are traceable. So I will say that kind of continuity, that kind of stability, that kind of appreciation for that which has gone before and the ones who have gone before us has really resonated with the guys that we've talked to. Mm. But again, the reason why it's a little bit hard for me to answer is those guys kind of know that when they start the conversation with us. Mm-hmm. And so by the time they get to us, they're intrigued by those very things. Mm. And so it's not a representative sample, but it's definitely noticeable that those things are not a turnoff. Those actually have great appeal.
Yeah, I'm encouraged by it. I don't know so much either, but given what we do, people, you know, find Reform Forum or are interested in our materials. Usually they're down a path already. I mean, I would like to be doing more work and producing more resources that are a little bit, this is going to sound so stupid, but from a business perspective, the phrase would be top of the funnel. So that, you know, talking about a marketing or a sales mentality, the broad out there, you know, casting the net widely to whosoever out there saying, hey, this is what we do. And you gather those people and you start to train them up and start, you know, funneling them down to more specifics. So we don't do a whole lot of top of the funnel stuff, which I'd like to change. We have a little big gospel track now, but that's beside the point. So whatever I would notice would be anecdotal as well. But I'd like to think that the culture is changing, and I find I'm encouraged by that people are just getting tired of what was probably more common when we were in high school and college from our generation, just thinking about, truth is relative and you know, you got to find out what's good for you, and you have your faith, I have my faith, and then nothing's objective. Everything is subjective, and whether it was postmodern or post-postmodern, or as Dr. Truman likes to talk about, the rise and triumph of the modern self, you know, that everyone determines their own reality and their own world, and things are the way that I think they are. There seems to be a reaction to that no, this is nonsense. There are things that are objectively true. There are things out there that I don't want mealy mouth messages. I want someone to stand up and say what they believe unapologetically and hold to that. And whether I agree with it or not, we can actually know where we all stand rather than, you know, this wishy-washy gray area that we've been living in the last 20 years, I think.
There's something tremendously freeing about stating your convictions with clarity. Mm-hmm. It's freeing for you because you're being honest. It's freeing, I think, for even people who are getting to know you because they know where you stand, and you're not. They know you're not spinning them. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to cater to what you think they want to hear. I mean, on the seminary end, I'll tell you there are guys that I can think of that we've talked to along the way, and at some point we've said to them, you know, it sounds like really this isn't for you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is right. For a variety of reasons. Sometimes there are disqualifying things, but sometimes there are just areas where they're so committed to that kind of wishy-washiness that you're talking about, this isn't worth pursuing.
No.
And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's just tremendous, there are opportunities, and there's really just tremendous freedom in being open about your convictions, particularly if those convictions are supported by the scriptures.
Mm, absolutely. Let's see here. You got any other things?
Maybe add to one thing that I just said, because it comes full circle to what you were talking about at the beginning. This is one of the great benefits of creeds and confessions.
Yes.
Because if you have a confessional standard that is robust, that is specific, that really covers the whole range of of theological topics, then there's a sense in which, among other things, so it's helpful for inside the church and for keeping false teaching apart from the church, but actually it's also really helpful for engaging with the world, because there are no hidden messages here. You are openly stating what you believe with as much clarity as you can, and boy, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if people are going to reject what you're teaching, they know what you're teaching, and there's not any kind of bait and switch if you're really committed to confessionalism.
Yes, everyone has a creed and a confession, whether or not they want to write it down for you.
Well, that's right. That's right. And
it's much better to be open and explicit about it.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I was talking to a mutual acquaintance of ours. Was it last night or the night before? And this brother was telling a story about somebody who had been a member of a church, and then circumstances changes, the pastor, you know, either left or passed away, but whatever, that they were reflecting on this pastor's ministry. And then that got them thinking and looking more into the specifics of what that church believed. And this member came to find out that this church believed all sorts of things that they didn't agree with.
Yes.
Which leads you to question, how is it possible that somebody becomes a member of a church and doesn't understand like basic things like this church is not for gay marriage and stuff like that?
Right, right, right.
And that just comes back to maybe where we started in terms of the education. Are we hiding the specifics from people, or are we not only living these things, but, you know, certainly in new members' classes, but in our teaching and our sermons, are we proclaiming the full counsel of God, but also are we doing that using our standards to be very clear what we actually believe?
Yeah. Right, and it's such a great blessing if indeed you are persuaded, as I am, that these standards faithfully represent biblical truth. What a great blessing it is to be able to simply open that up to people and to be clear with them about these things that we know are so significant that the Bible teaches.
Mm-hmm. What's on tap for Greenville or for you in the next couple of months? I know we've got the conference here in March. That's a ways away, but it sneaks up on you.
Yeah. And, yeah, seminary, that's a big one.
You've sure got plenty of other things going on. What are you most excited about?
Well, personally, I am doing a fair amount of traveling, so I'm always excited to visit churches and have opportunities to open God's Word. At the seminary, you're right, the big public event, we have a lot of internal events happening.
And there's a school year going on.
And there's a school year going on. We're actually, you know, having classes right now. But the next big public event is our March confessional conference.
Yeah.
And it's always, you know, because you're a regular attender, and it is always a real delight to gather together with the people that come
it's
to
amazing.
That conference. Yeah, it's an incredible conference, an incredible week. And so I'd encourage anyone who's listening to go to gpts.edu. You can click on the events page.
Yeah.
You can get more information. But we love having people come. we love having first-time visitors come. We love having people bring their families.
Yeah.
So it's just a really good week of teaching and a fellowship.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's definitely, it's for everybody. And then I just for fun, I was taking a walk. I think it was after lunch last time. You know, just to get the blood flowing, wake up after the after having a big, nice meal. And it's so family friendly. I think I counted 18, like, 15 passenger vans in the parking lot.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That's how friendly it is. And then it's fun to see, you know, there's a whole, it's almost a daycare. You know, there's childcare for everybody doing fun activities outside. So if you've got a big family and you're wondering, I don't know if I can make it or how are we going to watch all these kids? The kids are welcome. They're welcome in the sessions. They'll learn a lot. These are good sessions, but also there's plenty for them to do and lots of other families to connect with too. So it's great.
Yeah, it's a highlight for us every year, and we're looking forward to this year's.
Great. Well, Jonathan, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Thanks for taking the time to get on the microphones.
Camden, anytime, anytime. I love Reformed Forum. Love what you're doing. I mean this sincerely, not only that I'm willing to come on anytime, but what you are doing is just really remarkable. So very grateful.
Thank you very much. Likewise, it's an honor to work with you and to pull in the same direction, as I like to say, and it's by God's grace. So we're very thankful to be here. I'm very thankful to be here and have to pinch myself sometimes. I get to travel to places like this and talk to people I love about things I love and we all love. And it's like, really? This is what I get to do today?
It's amazing. Great joy.
Praise God. Well, thanks, brother.
Yep, thanks.
Thank you so much for watching this episode. I hope you enjoyed that conversation from the Reformation and Worship Conference, which was hosted at Midway PCA in Powder Springs, Georgia. We really enjoyed being there, and I enjoyed the conversations I had while I was there. Just as a reminder, go on to reformforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our news, updates, programs, books, events, everything that we have going on. We'd love to stay in touch with you. You can subscribe to our email newsletter. You can also send us a note at mail@reformedforum.org. But I do want to thank everybody for watching and for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.